VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Hello and welcome to Danny in the Valley, your weekly dispatch from deep inside the Silicon Valley future machine. Before we get to today's show with Sir Richard Branson, which is great, just a very quick heads up. Next week, if all goes well, we will have two pods for you, a double episode. Got some very cool stuff cooking, so please don't miss out on that. And also, before we go any further, go to Apple Podcast, give us a rating and review. You know, maybe write a few words. Please just press pause right now. I'd appreciate it. My life depends on it. My son's life depends on it. Okay, the stakes aren't that high, but do it anyway. Please, for me. Now, on to today's show.
Yo, technology, what is it all about?
I mean, my instinct is that the end of my lifetime and in my kids' lifetime that there will be pods traveling throughout the world and connecting the world much more quickly.
Thank you for tuning in. Today on Danny in the Valley, we have none other than Sir Richard Branson, the bearded billionaire behind Virgin Atlantic, Virgin Music, Virgin Galactic, Virgin Hyperloop One, Virgin Orbit, all kinds of stuff. Now you may be thinking, well, why do you have Richard Branson on a tech podcast? Well, for one, he has backed lots of startups, from Ring, the video doorbell company that Amazon just bought for $1 billion, to TransferWise, the money transfer giant, which is also a unicorn, and a bunch of others in between. But he's also directly involved in things like Hyperloop One, which is one of the companies working on this pretty far out idea of vacuum tubes to transport people and cargo in pods at airline speed or faster, but on the ground. You may remember we interviewed the other Hyperloop company back in season one. He has also, of course, poured tons of money, many hundreds of millions of dollars, into Virgin Galactic, his space tourism company, as well as Orbit, the satellite company. So he's up to a lot. Anyhow, he was in San Francisco last week, where I caught up with him at the site of a new Virgin Hotel. No, I didn't know that either. I didn't know Virgin Hotels were a thing. But anyhow, it was a building site, but we did take a very quick tour.
So that right here is going to be the bar, wow. The Commons Club. So that's the guest reception junction. That's just right over there. Uh-huh. You walk into the hotel.
Right.
That's the Shag Room, which is located just right here.
The
right.
Shag Room?
The Shag Room. Yes, it was still a lot of
the funny library, which will be the coffee shop.
Obviously, the Shag Room is unfinished, though given the name, not sure I'd want to do the interview there anyway. So we sat down in the conference room of his PR company in downtown San Francisco, and Branson looked like he's always seems to have looked. The flowing mane, the beard, the crisp white shirt tucked into his jeans, big wide grin. So we covered a lot of ground. We talked about his various adventures in startup land, why he keeps investing in his space company 13 years after starting, plowed in tons of money, and there was also, of course, this catastrophic test flight back in 2014 that killed a pilot. He also talks about when Hyperloop will carry its first passenger, whether he wants to live forever, and why later this year he plans to quite literally risk his life to go into orbit on Virgin Galactic's first commercial flight into space. And just before we get started, I wanted to thank all of you, the listeners and followers who sent in questions. We didn't get to nearly as many as I would have liked. As you'll see, Branson's mind doesn't exactly work in straight lines, which throughout his career has led to things like Virgin Cola and Virgin Brides, Yes, Virgin Brides. But it also has led to things like Virgin America, which when he sold it a couple years ago to Alaska Airlines, netted him something like $500 million cash. And of course, he lives on his very own island, Necker. Anyhow, I hope you enjoyed the discussion, and we started it with just a very basic question, which was, for someone who is flooded with thousands and thousands of business proposals and ideas, what gets him to say yes?
There's the main Virgin companies, which, you know, whether it's Virgin Galactic or Virgin Atlantic, or which often come about out of the frustration that that I feel it can be done better. And so, you know, we dive in and find teams of people and create, you know, special companies. And then there's investments in other people's companies. With Ring, for instance.
Oh, yeah. So I saw, because we actually had Jamie on the podcast last year, Jamie Siminoff, the founder of Ring. And obviously, he's had this amazing exit. He just sold for $1 billion to Amazon. But he told me the story. He went on Shark Tank and just got rejected.
I think somebody might have offered him some sort of derisory amount. But yeah, he just told me the idea of, you know, what he was doing. And I just felt, you know, I'd love one of those for my kids' home. So, you know, said that, you know, I'd love to jump in and take a stake in the company. You know, we became friends. In fact, I've got breakfast with him tomorrow morning in Miami. So, you know, we became friends. And, you know, when he had problems, he would ring me up, and occasionally I would maybe was able to help a bit.
Because he mentioned, yeah, that also that ADT, the big home security company, was suing him. And yeah, he said there was a lot of similarities between what BA tried to do to Virgin. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it was very similar. I think that big companies do not like small companies prodding their often fat and flabby tummies. and they decided to try to damage Jamie. And so I said, look, I'm lucky. I've got 40 million followers on our blog. I said I'd be delighted to blog about it and try to get some interest going, which hopefully would help make them back off somewhat, which I think ultimately they did. You know, we generally don't invest in things unless we can also participate, help when we can.
So bringing more than just money, because obviously,
yeah,
you have,
I mean,
plenty,
you know,
of money.
We do have a team that, you know, maybe do some investments for pure investment's sake. But generally, if we take 5, 10, 15, 20% of a company, you know, obviously I'm lucky I can, you know, maybe get through to anybody on the phone, or if I write a letter, I'll get it answered. And that can, on occasions, help at a critical moment in one of these new companies that are trying to get established. I mean, Memphis Meats, I think, is another good example of that, where, you know, the fact that I think that Bill Gates and myself have invested has given it great coverage.
Have you tried their meatball?
I have.
Because this is the test tube meat, basically.
Yeah, we're invested in a number of companies in this sector. So we're invested in Memphis Meats, which is effectively growing meat. They believe, and I really hope it's true, that companies like them plus them can get to sort of 50% of meat consumption in the next sort of 20, 30 years. And I gave up eating beef a number of years ago because of cows just munching into the rainforest effectively, and we're not going to have any rainforest left. And I don't think we're going to be able to persuade everybody to become vegetarian.
No.
But I think we can persuade everybody to switch to meat that doesn't kill animals, that tastes just as good, and that saves what's left of the rainforest when enough product is, you know, is actually available for people to eat.
Right. These companies are obviously doing very, very different things. Is there a commonality between them all? Is there something, are you investing in the people, the idea? Is there something that you look to first that you kind of gets you excited?
If we're talking about these smaller investments,
yeah,
we're obviously investing in people. We're investing in a good idea. And, you know, we're investing in companies which hopefully will give us a return so we can invest in other companies. And if possible, we're investing in companies that, you know, will make a real difference. So we have something called Audacious Ideas on Necker every year, which ourselves and Chris from TED host. And basically what we do is have a team of people who spend the year working on what are the sort of six most audacious ideas that can really change the world and make a real difference in the world. Out of 1,000 projects, they whittle down to maybe six. And then
wow,
the individuals then make a 10-minute video, and then we bring together some of the wealthiest people in the world to Necker, and these six projects or seven projects pitch to those people. And at the end of the day, we ring back these people and tell them whether or not they've been successful. And, you know, projects have got between sort of $50 and $100 million of philanthropy, you know, rather than investment, as you know, on these projects.
So these are can be businesses, but they can also be kind of NGO type organizations that you funnel them down. I imagine you just do an open call for ideas around the world.
They've all been philanthropic so far.
Oh, okay.
I'll just explain the philanthropic aspect and then explain the business aspect. So there's a horrible blindness called trichoma in Africa that still exists in about 10 countries, where the eyelids turn in on the eyes, and then the kids literally blink themselves blind, or adults even blink themselves blind. And it's still happening to hundreds of thousands of people in Africa. So, you know, they made a pitch, and with the idea of wiping out trichoma in every...
So who makes that pitch?
The people that are most equipped to deal with it. So actually, in this case, Sight Savers are leading the charge on that one. You know, so we committed, I think it was $60 million, but said that part of that commitment was that they needed to raise another $60 million on the back of the $60 million. And since then, Bill Gates and the British government and other people have come in with large amounts of money as well. Another organization was trying to use satellite technology to warn companies of where methane leaks were taking place, and they got their money.
And so how many people are in this kind of audacious ideas kind of pool of funders?
So far, it's been a small group of about 10 people.
So you have 10 of these uber wealthy people come spend a nice week or weekend.
Yeah.
It's just see these videos and then decide whether they're going to which
exactly. And they work. You know, we work together as a team on these things. So we follow up, and I've been to, you know, Switzerland, presented to Credit Suisse, his wealthiest clients. You know, so where we said, okay, you've now got to raise another $60 million, we'll then try to help them raise the matching money as well. And then, you know, at TED we've opened it up to the public to get involved as well. So at this year's TED conference, we've sort of said if the public want to come in and get involved, that can happen. So that's the philanthropic side. And then at one of these meetings, there was a wonderful man called Bill McGlashan, who runs TPG, a big venture capital thing. And he suggested that that maybe we can all put up, you know, we can be generous and we can give away all our money, but we also need organizations that are investing bigger sums of money in big projects on a for-profit basis that can make a big difference. Mm. So Bono, myself and he and a couple of other people agreed that we'd set up a purpose-driven fund, which TPG would manage. And they've gone out and raised $2 billion. And the idea is that if this fund can work, we can then hopefully tap into pension funds in the future to show, you know, if you have a purpose-driven fund, it doesn't have to be less profitable than a non-purpose-driven. And so they have very, very strict criteria on, you know, what makes for a purpose-driven company.
Right.
And they've got a fantastic team of people, you know, I mean, some dealing with health, some dealing with clean energy, and they've already made about 10 big investments.
So when did you start Virgin?
I was 15, and I'm 67 now, over 50 years ago.
Right.
Yeah, I was a dyslexic 15-year-old who was hopeless at school, but was interested in what was going on in the world, and the Vietnamese War was an atrocious war that was taking place, and a number of us felt passionately that it should stop. And you know, we decided to start an inter-school university magazine to try to campaign against it, and also to speak out on other issues. The Biafran War was going on, and it was the 60s, so it was an exciting time to be alive. And I was going to run the magazine from the school, but the headmaster said, you know, I had to choose between formal education, and if I wanted to do the magazine, I had to leave. And so I said, great, I'm off. and the magazine became my education, basically, and became it. There was Oz, It, and Student And the three, it was a great time to be running a magazine.
Yeah.
And we had Gerald Scarfe and Ralph Steadman and Peter Blake and, lots of fantastic people who sort of contributed to it. In those days when I did interviews, my tape recorder was that big.
Yeah, it's
big,
not this like real cool little sleek little black box, yeah.
No, I once went into, I knocked on the door of James Baldwin's hotel room to try to get an interview of him, and he opened the door, and I hadn't got a prearranged anything, and he looked pretty angry. But he, because I was 15, 16 years old, he sort of took pity on me and invited me in. And just after he invited me in, I sort of went back outside the door, and I carried this massive bloody tape recorder in. And then, of course, the plug was the wrong plug, so I had to ask him for
screwdriver.
A coin, and undo the thing, and then get some matches from. And by the time I did the interview with him, it was very much a very angry black man against a white man. Being young, I managed to bully our way into Jean-Paul Sartre and Vanessa Redgrave and lots of interesting people. And
I don't know if there's anything that's universal from over those years in your experience, because I imagine it also applies to what the companies you look at now. What are the things that work?
I think the most successful businesses that I've gone into have been businesses where I've just been frustrated with the way big companies are doing it, and I felt, screw this, I can get in and shake it up and do it a lot better. So the airline business we went into simply because I was actually bumped off a flight going from Puerto Rico to the Virgin Islands one day because they didn't have enough seats sold. I hired a plane and got a blackboard and jokingly wrote Virgin Airlines one way to and $39 and filled up the plane. And the next day rang up Boeing and asked if they had any secondhand 747s for sale. And everybody thought we were mad. One plane against BA's 300, and then you had Pan Am with 300 and TWA with 300. What chance would you have? But if you feel passionately that you can do it better and you do go in and create an airline that's better, and your staff feel passionately that Virgin Atlantic was better, and you make it fun, and you have a chance of succeeding. And even when British Airways launched the Dirty Tricks campaign against us, because people stuck with us and enjoyed the airline, we survived. Whether it's banking or whether it was health clubs or, music, we went into music shops because music was really expensive in those days. And we just thought, let's set up, shops that can sell music cheaper than anybody else.
Yeah.
And, we had to get Ted Heath to abolish retail price maintenance, which in those days, believe it or not, everybody had to sell everything for the same price. So we managed to get the law changed.
That sounds very communist.
It was very, it was. But fortunately, anyway, Ted Heath wasn't a communist. So then we managed to get in there and discount music. So it's very rare. It's very rare that I think at Virgin that we thought, right, how can we make a lot of money? What business can we go into that can make us money? It's almost always been a passion, and the great advantage of it doing it based on a passion is I'm committed, the people around me are committed. We may not make as much money as, say, if we'd gone into conventional tech or something like that. But I think if you say take Virgin America, the airline here in the States, it was the best airline, in the every year traveling for the last 12 years. It was it shook up the industry, and I think most likely improved the competition as well. And the only reason we did it was because other airlines were so awful.
One of your big investments is Hyperloop. What problem is that solving? Why are you investing in that?
Since I was in my 20s, maybe early 30s, I resigned all my directorships, all my chairmanships, and I've delegated everything to other people. And so I could spend more time on setting up not-for-profit ventures and just looking at the bigger picture, and just starting new companies but not getting bogged down with the running of companies. There was a genius engineer at Virgin Galactic called Josh Geigel. And he left one day, and we were all very sad to see him go. And then he emerged again a few months later, and he'd been beavering away, setting up Virgin, well, in those days, Hyperloop One. So I decided to go and see what he was doing, went out to the desert outside Las Vegas, saw what he'd accomplished in an incredibly short period of time.
And the Hyperloop is effectively a giant horizontal vacuum tube transportation at the speed of sound or faster.
Exactly. I looked into what the competition was doing and felt that Josh was way ahead of everybody else. And I was they asked if I would be chairman, and I decided to sort of come out of come out and take on the role, because I felt that it really deserved to be successful, and it was not going to be easy. I mean, you know, Josh is a young guy, and I can open doors. You know, so for instance, we've signed up a fantastic route in India, Mumbai to Pune, the busiest road route in India, hundreds of accidents and deaths every year.
So I guess that's the question: what problem is it solving?
It's so many problems. I mean, I'll just give you, well, on that it will literally save thousands of lives. Instead of people sitting in traffic for 5 hours, they can jump on a Hyperloop, they can work, they can be there in a little over half an hour, and it will transform people's lives. I mean, it's just miserable sitting in traffic in India. But there's even more exciting things that it can do. I mean, let's just give you another example. Dubai has one airport. It's building another airport 70 miles from that airport, which will take maybe a couple of hours to go between airports. If you put a Hyperloop between those two airports, you can get across town in 10 minutes instead of 2 hours. But then when you actually get to the airport, pods can just go off to the New York gate, the JFK gate, the Timbuktu gate, and the pods can be the size of however many passengers are going on that particular journey. So you're not only saving the 2 hours going across town, you're then saving the 2 hours going through the airport and the misery of the airport experience. You know, by the time that airport's built, there will be technology which will mean that the bags can go straight on the plane. Eye recognition will you may have already checked in at one airport. You won't have to, because you're in a tube and not in a car. You can go straight to your gate, or eye recognition. If you haven't already checked in at one, should be able to allow you to go straight to your gate and get on the plane.
Customs bollocks. Just
avoid all that rubbish. And cargo. Let's give you a cargo example of benefits of Hyperloop. So most of the docks, a lot of docks, and again, let's just take Dubai, are on valuable real estate land, which would be much better suited to hotels and beaches than cargo containers and lorries coming to and from. You know, if you put a little island just off Dubai, say, and you unload the cargo onto a Hyperloop, the Hyperloop can whisk that cargo 20 miles inland, and the lorries can come and pick it up 20 miles inland, and you can then sell all the real estate. So, I mean, my instinct is that the end of my lifetime, and in my kids' lifetime, that there will be pods traveling throughout the world, and connecting the world much more quickly and much more environmentally friendly. I mean, that's the final point, I think, is that they will be electrically run. You can have solar on the roofs of the tubes. So it'll be clean technology as well.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So before this interview, I asked kind of listeners and followers to send in questions for you. And Hyperloop was the one that got the most questions.
Interesting.
And so I have a few I wanted to ask you. One is from Eric Owusu. Does Branson see the success of Hyperloop as a threat to the aviation industry? And does he expect the routes to mirror short-haul flights, flight routes?
I think that in time that short-haul flights will be affected by Hyperloop, yes. Because, you know, if you had Hyperloop, say, between London and Edinburgh or London and Glasgow, which are, I think people would almost definitely prefer to jump on a Hyperloop than jump on a plane. Because
it would take around the same amount of time?
Well,
roughly?
Generally airports are a long way from a city.
Yeah.
Hyperloop can go straight into the city. You don't have all the hassle being at the airport. But obviously long-haul travel, you know, will still exist, but short-haul travel, I think, will be affected.
Is it a pipe dream, though? I mean, because it's so much infrastructure you have to build, and it's such a massive undertaking to build this thing.
It's much, much less of a massive undertaking than you'd imagine. I mean, like, we've got quotes from Chinese manufacturers, for instance. Mm. The speed that they could lay out the Hyperloops is remarkable.
In China or in
anywhere right. Anywhere in the world. And then, you know, very quickly India and other places will start competing with the Chinese on this. So the key, we've got this very short test run in Las Vegas. We're now building 20-kilometer track in India, and that will, you know, test Virgin Hyperloop at full speed.
Which is how fast?
It's capable. It's capable, but with freight anyway, of going somewhere between 600 and 1,000 miles an hour. With people, we've still got to work out just, you know, the G forces and what's comfortable. But let's say, you know, 500-600 miles an hour is the possibility. Once it's certified we've bedded down the teething problems, which you're obviously inevitably going to get with a new technology, then I think one can roll it out city to cities very quickly.
Sam Van Rood says, when and where will the first passenger commute by Hyperloop?
I think India is likely to be the first place. So I think Mumbai to Pune seems to be the likely first route.
And when do you think that will happen?
I've made the mistake of guessing timings with my space company, and I maybe shouldn't start now. But anyway, let's say within... Within 3 years? No? Okay, I'm not allowed to.
Get the no from the minder.
Anyway, hopefully within 3 or 4 years anyway.
Right. Oh, before we get to space, do you still own Twitter stock?
A little bit, but not much. I think Twitter, Jack Dorsey came to NECA many years ago, and I mean, quite a lot of things like Square, Twitter, and other things.
Oh, because you're an investor in Square as well, right? Which is also one of
the
companies.
We came about from just discussions at the bar on NECA.
You should do a podcast, just like
true. We get most of the most interesting people in the world, or most.
It seems like quite a fertile territory for business ideas.
We do a lot of brainstorming sessions on, you know, organizations that should be set up on, you know, maybe on a not-for-profit basis to tackle particular problems on NECA. And so we get some of the really fascinating people come there.
Yeah.
And I'm always wanting to learn, keep my ears open, always fascinated by listening to, you know, people and what they're up to and what their ideas are. And, you know, sometimes we'll jump in and help them in the early days.
Space. the final frontier, so to speak. So I actually went. I went there to your operation in Mojave. I guess it was 2 years ago now, roughly, which is very impressive. But obviously, it's what you're trying to do is not easy. Where are things now? You know, it's kind of the same question with Hyperloop. When does space tourism start? And in addition to that, why?
Okay, let's deal with the why first. You know, this is by far and away the toughest challenge we've set ourselves, the longest challenge we've set ourselves. I mean, Virgin Atlantic we got going in 4 months, and we're now 13 years into our space program.
And what, like $1 billion, I would guess?
No, over $1 billion. So, you know, the old saying, it's not rocket science. Well, obviously with space, it is rocket science.
Right.
We've got 600 of the brightest scientists and engineers working on Virgin Galactic. We've got another couple of hundred working on Virgin Orbit, on OneWeb.
Virgin Galactic is the tourism arm. Virgin Orbit is the launching satellites into space.
Exactly.
Right.
And then you've got OneWeb, which was also conceived, well, also much of it was conceived on the bar at NECA with a guy called Greg Weiler.
I've spoken to him. He's quite an impressive guy.
Yeah, he's passionate, and you have to be passionate. That's a big project as well. Yeah, so we were the main investors in that with Qualcomm from day one. So first of all, let's start with OneWeb. I mean, OneWeb and Virgin Orbit, their remit is to try to help connect the 4 billion people who are not connected. If you're not connected, it's going to be more and more difficult to start businesses, to get health advice out in rural places, education. I mean, we all know how important connection is these days. And and the demand, I think, for small satellites is growing exponentially. And we are the really only company that's going to launch small satellites into space at 24 hours notice from a 747 that used to be part of Virgin Atlantic's fleet.
Because it's basically being retrofitted where you have the rocket under the wing. And
attached to the wing.
Yeah. Yeah, and then it takes off from whatever, 35,000 feet, basically drop
40,000 feet, yeah.
Right.
And generally people have to wait 6 months, a year to get on a big rocket. So we can literally, and you can only go to one area the world. So with the 747, we can fly anywhere in the world with that 747. We can put that satellite up anywhere in the world. And we can come back. We can pick up another satellite within 24 hours and put another rocket up with more satellites up. So we think there's going to be a big market for Virgin Orbit, and that's planned for September of this year to do our first satellite into space. And and that's been many years. A long process to get there, but hopefully September, and it'll be tremendously exciting to see the 747 take off and to see the rocket drop and hopefully go into space. All the ground testing has gone really well. You know, the history of first rockets being successful
is quite patchy.
We'll see how it goes. But anyway, if we don't see it on the first rocket, we'll obviously build another one straight away. But hopefully we'll be successful on the first rocket. And we have a big order book of people of satellites to send into space. And then on Virgin Galactic, we had an extremely good test flight 6 weeks ago. We have another one in 2 weeks' time, which is just a little bit higher than the previous one. Then the one after that, we hope to go to the edge of space, maybe in another couple of months' time. And then the one after that, all going well, we'll go into space in maybe another 2 months after that. And you know, obviously, there's always a possibility that something will show up that will mean that, you know, we'll have to do some more work on the craft or something, and we'll have to delay it. But
So all going well, though, that could happen later this year.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And all going well, if all that goes well, then I hope by the end of the year to go into space. And
would you be on that first?
I'll be on the first official flight into space. So we'll have had, you know, two astronauts take the spaceship into space, you know, as a test flight, you know, hopefully in the sort of late summerish, and they will be the first sort of private spaceship people to ever be in space, and then I'll be the first sort of owner, I suppose, if it all goes well, or the first first official person, you know, into space, all going well.
So what's the why on space tourism? Because, you know, I'm sure you've heard no end of critics who say this is just indulgence of rich people who want to pay $250,000 to go in a spaceship.
Yeah, I mean, when flight began across the Atlantic, people criticized rich people for flying across the Atlantic. So you got and the price was roughly the same as what we're charging. So by spending 13 years developing a craft that's capable of doing this, it's going to be the beginning of you know, supersonic travel. It's going to be one day, you know, the moon could be inhabited, and it could be the start of people being able to go to the moon on a regular basis. It could be, you know, one day the start of people going and staying in a hotel off the moon. But space is transformative for everything on Earth. Do we want to check how much methane is being released in the world? Methane is 18 times more damaging than carbon release. Yes, we do. You know, by opening up space, we're going to be able to check on things like this. Do we want to try to avoid the damage that the Hurricane Irma did to the Caribbean through space? that's a possibility that we can do that. You know, do we want to learn more about medical breakthroughs through space? We'd like to be able to do that. But equally, people who've been into space, I mean, there's a wonderful book called The Overview Effect, which is interviews of all the people who've been into space. I mean, they have come back as very committed to, you know, having seen the world from space, you know, making the world a better place. The initial pioneers who are going to pay a lot of money will help enable Virgin Galactic to bring the price down for, you know, future people to go into space at a much better price. And if we can make it a business out of it, which I think we can, that will enable us to do more and more and more exciting things in the space field.
So shooting rich people into space is kind of step one of a much broader plan.
Of course.
Right. Yeah.
You know, we've got quite a lot of money that we'd like to try to get back. Initially, you do need wealthy people to help pay that back. But we're still talking about, you know, if a wealthy person wants to go up in a Russian spaceship, it's $40 million. If they want to go up on a Virgin Galactic spaceship, it's $250,000,
$300,000. Right.
You know, the price is already, you know, it's already dropping.
It's six seats in the...
Yeah. Right. And the environmental cost is almost negligible, and I think we're almost going to get it to zero. So I mean, we're now showing, you know, the very fact that we're launching people, you know, from the air rather than from the ground, reduces.
You don't need all that thrust.
Right. And we think we're going to be able to quite soon be able to put people to space in an almost benign manner, which will be very exciting. And we'll also, you know, we can talk about, you know, what we're doing with Virgin Atlantic and others on that, but that's another, maybe for another podcast. But and I'll just say, you know, if people want to become astronauts, why, that something, shouldn't they? I mean, it's, yeah, you know, like it's people only live once, and you know, they'd love the chance to, you know, go to space, which NASA and the Russian governments would never be interested in letting people do, and they can afford it. Why shouldn't they have the pleasure of being able to do it?
And is that those first six seats, that first flight, the first commercial flight, is that already set? Do you know who's going on that, aside from yourself? Do you know who the other five are?
We have an announcement to make, which we haven't completely bedded down quite yet. But anyway, it will involve...
Go ahead.
it will in some form or another involve members of the public, which... it'll be myself and others.
That sounds very mysterious. I just have a few more questions, reader questions, a couple of random ones here. Nico Hernopoulos asks,
Wow, what wonderful names you've got.
I know.
Listen to your podcast.
It's a broad church. Please ask him if he feels contemporary musicians are as bold and as inventive today as they were when Virgin started. Also, any thoughts on the vinyl renaissance?
Yes, I think they are just as inventive as they were. I mean, it's much tougher for them, though, because...
Music industry is very different.
It's been gone. I mean, like, you know, when the Rolling Stones were playing, there weren't tons of people who played before them, so they could be unique much more easily now than, you know, than 30, 40, 50 years on, when, you know, pretty well every riff has been done.
Yeah.
And so that you have to be even more inventive today than you had to be then. I mean, I loved seeing the renaissance of vinyl. I went into a Virgin megastore in Dubai in Saudi Arabia last week and almost wept. It was just so lovely just to see a Virgin megastore still open somewhere in the world. And I sometimes wish that, you know, Times Square, Oxford Street, or you know, the Champs-Élysées, all those wonderful Virgin megastores were still there selling vinyl. Maybe we should reopen one in the West on the back of the vinyl comeback.
And this one is from Andrew M. It's kind of interesting. He says, has the Me Too movement changed your thoughts on how you do business, or more specifically, how you market, given that historically Virgin has used attractive women as a selling point in your strategy and image?
It's a good question. I don't think we've changed our approach. I would turn up to launch a business and, you know, Kate Moss, I would pick her up on the wings of one of our planes, and obviously, you know, that meant that Virgin Atlantic got known all over the world, and the press lapped up the pictures, and you know, she enjoyed it. I think everybody had a good time. So I'm not. I think it's important to get the balance right and not to go, you know, from one extreme to the other. As long as no harm is being done, I think it's okay. So I don't think it's got in the way.
So, being out here, we were just discussing earlier before we started recording all the kind of weird, wonderful ideas you come across here. One of the kind of obsessions here amongst a lot of people is eternal life, defeating aging, or kind of. Do you have any interest in that field, either as an investor or personally? Because, I mean, you meet a lot of people here who are taking all kinds of interesting things, kind of off book, et cetera, or investing extraordinary amounts of money in companies that are promising to extend life or extend the quality of life. So effectively, you can live till 100 and feel fighting fit, and then you just die, or 120 or whatever it may be.
Well, I have interesting debates with people who are committed to trying to live forever. My own feeling...
You must meet a lot of them at Necker, I imagine, at the bar.
I do. and I was thinking of one in particular that I had this debate with recently, but, you know, he's putting a lot of money into this. And actually, I think it's slightly selfish. I think we've got to make room for our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. And the world, I just don't think, can cope with us living forever. You know, even although I suspect one day it may well be possible for us to live forever.
Well, especially if we colonize the moon, for example.
Yeah.
Move us on out.
But, my instinct anyway is to live as healthy a life as I possibly can. I mean, I get up in the morning, I, you know, play a hard game of singles tennis every morning, every evening, go kite surfing, you know, keep fit and healthy.
You go kite surfing?
Yeah. I love kiting.
We live not far from the water here, and okay. I see the kite surfers, and that's serious business.
If the wind is up, it's
no joke.
But it looks far more risque than it actually is. So
right.
So I'd recommend that anybody listening to this program gives it a go. You know, 6 hours, you should be up and away, and it's easier to learn than skiing, and you get more pleasure than skiing, and it costs next to nothing. Just get yourself a kite. So. And a board, and maybe have somebody keep an eye on you in case your kite goes down out to sea. But
small detail,
little detail. So I just a great believer. Live your life to its absolute fullest while you're here, and um, your life lives on through your children and your grandchildren and the closeness of your friends and your family and, you know, what the difference you make while you're here. And I think a life pill, if I was offered it, would I take it? Maybe I would be selfish and take it. I don't know. If I could get my, if you could get your body back to be a 25-year-old's yeah. body, and the problem is people are going to want to have more children, and I think that this world can't take us all living forever somehow.
Last question: you've been in business for 50 plus years. How's your motivation changed? What's the goal now?
I still love learning. You know, I never went to university. Every day I feel is like a university education I never had, and I still love putting that learning to good use. So, you know, we're just talking about you know, the damage we're doing to this world. I mean, obviously climate change is a tremendous worry, but it's also tremendously exciting to see if entrepreneurs can come up with breakthrough technologies to make sure that we don't destroy the world. And, you know, I'm involved in the Breakthrough Energy coalition that Bill...
I met them.
Yeah, okay, so...
Yeah, yeah. The fund here, there's
with,
a fund
with,
here.
With Bill Gates and
yeah.
others,
yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And...
Cooper is runs
yeah.
the place. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I mean, on our little island, you know, we now power the island with solar, with wind, with batteries, and, you know, trying to use our little microcosm of an island to try to help make sure the whole of the Caribbean can, you know, after the hurricane, can become carbon neutral and are working with people like the Breakthrough Energy Coalition and others to get there. So most of my time is now spent on not-for-profit ventures like, you know, we have something called the Carbon War Room, which we merged with the Rocky Mountain Institute, where we're going in and advising and helping companies to become carbon neutral. We're going into different African countries one at a time, showing them how they can become carbon neutral. So Rwanda, so we just finished doing a big report in Rwanda and showing them how they can save a ton of money on energy, but also go carbon neutral. Now moving on to Kenya and so on.
Right.
And instead of becoming a serial entrepreneur, we've become a sort of serial philanthropist entrepreneur. So, you know, where we're setting up organizations just to tackle the some of the bigger problems in the world that we personally are very interested in. Drug reform. I mean, I'm part of something called the Global Drug Commission, which was set up 10 years ago. It has 15 ex-presidents. I think I'm the only business leader on it. And we've done, you know, a lot of studies on the war on drugs with one voice. We believe the war on drugs has been an abject failure. And for the last 10 years, we've been behind the scenes pushing governments to change their drug policies and try to treat drugs as a health problem, not a criminal problem. In fact, the only country in the world that has dealt with it properly is Portugal, and where at the turn of the century they, you know, made an announcement and they said anybody who's got a heroin problem, nobody's going to go to prison again. Come forward. We will arrange for you to get your heroin. We'll arrange for you to get your injection. We'll make sure you don't overdose. We'll have you supervised
right.
for your injection, and then when you're ready to wean yourself off, we will help you do so. And they had the kind of nightmare problem that America or Britain or other countries have got today, but they got rid of it, and it's become a non-event.
Wow.
Again, we're doing reports. We're trying to get governments to follow that line. And anyway, so we've got a number of different organizations like this where we feel that we can work, you know, with the social sector, with government, in trying to, you know, improve things and use our entrepreneurial skills to try to change things.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
And that is all the time we have. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. As I said, we will be back next week with one, possibly two podcasts for you. And in the meantime, you can find me, as ever, in the newspaper in the Sunday Times, online at thetimes.co.uk, on Twitter at Danny Fortson, on the electronic mail at danny.fortson@sunday-times.co.uk, and generally just around the old interwebs. So thanks again. We will talk to you next week. Have a good weekend. Bye-bye.
Thank you. approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.